This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The scene is Gainesville, Florida, 2012. Federal agents enter the home of Eric Procopi. They're not looking for your typical contraband. They're looking for dinosaur bones.
The investigation also led, as you may know, to the successful criminal prosecution of an individual, Eric Procopi, who had imported a slew of illegally looted Mongolian dinosaur fossils.
Well, that was then U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, who called Procopi a one-man black market for fossils. Procopi's collection and sale of an ultra-rare Tarbosaurus batar skeleton touched off an international custody battle and threw light on the financial and cultural costs of fossil smuggling. This hour on Point, a true crime story 70 million years in the making. And you can join us. Do you often visit museums and look at fossil displays? And have you ever wondered how they got there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, in a couple of moments, we hope to be joined by Paige Williams. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of a great new book called Dinosaur Artist, or The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. But as these things go, she's trapped in traffic right now, so we're hoping to hear from Paige pretty soon as she can get to the studio. But joining us first, until we hear from Paige, is Kirk Johnson. He is a paleontologist and the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, and he's with us today from Washington. Kirk Johnson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So this isn't exactly the order of operations that we thought we'd go through. And when Paige gets here, I want her to have her tell us the story of Eric Procopi in detail, because it's a really fascinating one. But, I mean, you're there in the middle of all this. You're at the Smithsonian. You're a paleontologist yourself. I mean, what's your take? Like, how deep is the black market for fossils in this around the world?
It's pretty large, and I think the key point is that some countries have fossils that they can export, and other countries don't. And there's five major countries in the world that produce a lot of dinosaurs. It's Canada, China, Mongolia, Argentina, and the United States. And only the United States has a legal dinosaur market. All the rest of those countries don't allow the export of dinosaurs for sale. In the United States, if the fossil comes off of private land, it's owned by the landowner and can be legally sold. If it's off of federal land, it belongs to the people of the nation and it can't be sold. So that's kind of the context into which fossil smuggling happens. And when we see a dinosaur come into the country from Canada or China or Mongolia or Argentina, we know right off the bat that it wasn't legally collected.
I see. Okay, so these are ones that are coming in and ending up in collections or museums? Because, I mean, I was at the Museum of Natural History in New York not long ago, marveling at the titanosaur they have there, which I think was discovered in Patagonia.
That's right, in Argentina. So museums routinely exchange fossils or loan fossils, and the titanosaur in New York is a cast of the original that was found in Argentina.
Uh-huh.
And some of the original bones in New York, but they're on loan from the Argentinian Museum to the New York Museum. So museums trade, and museums are assiduous in watching for where the fossils come from. And you won't find an American museum that has illegally exported fossils. That's sort of rule number one in the museum, is everything that comes into the museum comes in ethically and is absolutely clean.
I have a question about, can you be sure about that? Because in the fine art world, for example, over the past many years, we've been having, museums saying, well, actually, when we look at the provenance of our paintings, for example, they were, you know, taken from, they're actually owned by families of Holocaust victims, and we need to return them because they were stolen by the Nazis, or they were, you know, taken 100, 200 years ago from Native peoples, and we need to return them. So can we have that same sense of assuredness with fossils?
Yeah, the way we do it is that most museums now don't buy that many fossils. What they do is go out and collect their own fossils. And in across the American West, every summer there's dozens of teams from various museums working legally on federal land collecting fossils. They're not only getting the fossils, they're getting the scientific context with those fossils. So the data, the fossils, and they work closely with the land managers to make sure everything's clean and legal. The rare fossils that are purchased by North American museums have a very clear train of provenance right back to the hole in the ground where they came from.
Okay, and so even for fossils that have been in the collection for a century?
Well, some of the laws have evolved over time, too. So, for instance, if you were collecting fossils in Canada in 1910, it's different rules than there were now. So the rules have evolved. So some museums have fossils that were collected elsewhere. So, for instance, the American Museum has fossils from Mongolia that were collected during the 1922 expeditions of Roy Chapman Andrews. Uh-huh. Before there were laws in Mongolia prohibiting fossil export.
But if Mongolia were to come now and say, laws have evolved, laws have changed, so we want those fossils back, what would happen?
Well, that sort of gets into the whole issue of international museum repatriation. And most of the museums in the world are in Europe and North America, but they explored the whole world and brought stuff back from all over the world. So whether it's archaeological or anthropological things or fossils or even biological samples, there is a question of how did you get these things? Did you have permits at the time? Do you own them, or are they owned by definition by the country of origin? And those are very complicated case-by-case bases.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about this Tarbosaurus batar. Did I say that right? Okay.
You did.
Okay,
you did.
Tarbosaurus batar. The almost complete skeleton that was at the center of the story of Eric Prokopy. I mean, did you remember hearing about it when it came up for auction, in 2012-ish?
Yeah, absolutely I did. And I watched the fossil auction markets pretty closely. I've worked in China and Canada and Mongolia and Argentina, so I know the kinds of fossils that come out of those places. I study fossil plants from the time of dinosaurs, so I'm a peripheral viewer of the whole dinosaur world. And I'm very aware when something that looks funny pops on the market, and certainly a complete Tarbosaurus. And they're very distinctive animals. They're like a Tyrannosaurus rex, but a little bit smaller, and they have very beautiful white bone preservation. I found a couple myself when I was in Mongolia, and they're really obvious what they are. So when that thing popped on the market, like, whoa, there's a whole Tarbosaurus.
For auction,
sale,
yeah.
In New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So how did it get there? Interesting. Well, we have the answer to that question now because Paige Williams is joining us.
Excellent.
She's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine and author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Paige, are you there?
I'm there. I'm here.
Hi.
Sorry.
Traffic is not your fault. We're just glad that you're able
to. It's UN week in New York. So it's one of those gridlock days. And it's nice and mad out there.
Gridlock and security in combination makes for
all of those
very long commutes. Okay. So yeah. I'm really glad to have you. And Kirk Johnson has been doing a great job sort of walking us through the
I have no doubt about that.
That museums are thinking about these days when it comes to fossil collection and display and acquisition. But, you know, we were just talking about that Tarbosaurus batar that's at the heart of the story of Eric Prokopy. And to tell us about it, in 2012, this very rare complete skeleton of an apex predator shows up in New York for auction. How did that happen?
Well, the story subject of the book, Eric Prokopy, had decided he had been dealing in Ice Age megafauna of Florida for years and years, and had decided that he needed a bigger challenge and a bigger payout. And so he got hooked up. I don't want to spoil anything for readers, but he got hooked up with a Mongolian connection that began supplying him with dinosaur parts. The Gobi Desert, as Kirk has probably already said, is just there's an abundance of Cretaceous fossil dinosaurs there, and there was a fella in Ulaanbaatar who had decided to market these bones, and Prokopy got hooked up with him and began shipping body parts into the United States and putting them together himself in his backyard workshop in Gainesville, Florida.
His 5,000 square foot workshop that he built.
That's right.
Right.
You have a good memory. That's right. It was a 5,000 square foot warehouse with like four or five bays. He stored boats and body parts and shark teeth and all kinds of things that interested him in there, and then did his work in there. He needed a higher pitch of a roof for his new line of work, which was large dinosaurs. This Tarbosaurus batar that you're talking about, that we're talking about, was 24 feet long and 8 feet tall. So he needed something a little bit bigger than your average garage.
Well, so just to be clear here, I mean, he wasn't a museum affiliated paleontologist, right? He was an amateur collector. I mean, how do we describe him?
Yeah, no. He had volunteered at the Florida Museum of Natural History while he was in college at the University of Florida. And then something happened while he was in service there that led him to part ways with that museum. But he was very much interested in the science to begin with and then got turned off by that side of it. So a lot of these guys call themselves commercial paleontologists, but they're not paleontologists at all. I don't mean to sound harsh when I say that, but they're commercial hunters and they're commercial dealers. The paleontologists are the scientists, and they're the ones who worked hard for that for that title. And it's not that the commercial guys don't work hard. They do, just in a very different way. So they may call themselves, I don't know, Kirk, what do they?
Well, I mean, some of them, there's a range of knowledge sets, and some of the commercial paleontologists really know a tremendous amount about their subject and have gone on to even get advanced degrees. And some of the early ones that worked in North America were the most knowledgeable people about dinosaurs. But you're right, their focus is different. They're acquiring things, they love them, and they have a business that sells them, as opposed to scientists who are collecting them to study them and understand them and preserve them for the benefit of the public.
Mm. Right. And so, Paige, we're heading into a break here, but when this Tarbosaurus batar shows up at auction, I'm remembering from your New Yorker piece from, 2013? Is that when you mm-hmm. first published about it?
Yeah,
but, you paint a kind of a gripping scene here where, like, the auction is underway and a man named Robert Painter, like, stands up and stops the auction.
He did. He's a lawyer in Houston, Texas, who happened to know, as one does when you're a lawyer from Texas, the president of Mongolia, President Elbig Dorje. And Elbig Dorje had, when the dinosaur auction came to Elbig Dorje's attention, he reached out to Painter, and Painter was the one who stood up in the auction, waved his BlackBerry, and said, I have a judge in Texas on the phone. This has to stop.
Okay, well, we're going to pick up that story when we come back. We're speaking with Paige Williams. She is a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine and author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. And we're talking about the international fossil trade, the fossil black market, also how they end up in museums around the world. And Kirk Johnson is with us as well. He's paleontologist and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today about fossil smuggling or the international black market for fossils and the impact that has on the countries where these precious artifacts of natural history come from. Particularly, we'll talk about Mongolia here in a minute. And we're joined today by Paige Williams. She's staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Dinosaur Artists, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. And also with us today is Kirk Johnson. He's paleontologist and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. And Paige, before the break, we were sort of talking about this moment in 2012 where this fantastic Tarbosaurus batar skeleton was up for auction in New York. And there's a particular quote here from a lawyer or a judge that was representing the auction house when this dispute over the provenance of the skeleton mm-hmm. came up. And the auction house's attorney, you quote this person as saying to the Mongolian government, that although we appreciate your concerns, it is our conclusion that no impropriety exists. Mongolia won its independence in 1921, and this specimen is quite a bit older than that. I mean, I wanted to point that out because it gets to the heart of this question here of like who should have ownership over these rare treasures.
It does. A lot of collectors feel like the earth belongs to everybody, and that the constructs, the legal and societal constructs that have been laid over the earth in all these millennia, don't apply to them in some cases. And that was an interesting quote from the lawyer. That was a lawyer for the auction house, and it was such an interesting grab at defense, and one that I had not heard before. Obviously, this case was unprecedented, so nobody had ever heard of anything sort of like this before, internationally anyway. So
my first reaction was, how would they feel if Mongolian fossil hunters came to Utah and started digging up there?
Right, which they do. But as one person, Jeff Fault, the husband of Oyuna, the aide to President El-Bagdorj, said, he's like, that's like telling the Saudis that they're not entitled to their oil. So it was an interesting grab at a defense or as an excuse.
Kirk Johnson, jump in here. I mean, when you hear that kind of quote, what does it make you think?
Well, I think it was kind of silly. I mean, it talks about national sovereignty and who owns land and property, and there's property laws in every country. So you're sort of pretending that the country doesn't exist and the property laws don't exist.
And so, Paige, tell us what ultimately happened to this skeleton.
Well, the lawyer, Robert Painter, was not successful with his temporary restraining order, but Mongolia was able to, through Painter, to take possession of the dinosaur, to put it into storage. And for the government, the federal government, the U.S. government stepped in and asked Robert Painter, as he was on the tarmac headed back to Houston from New York, you want some help. And as it happened, this was Sharon Cohen Levin, who was the head of the asset forfeiture unit at the Southern District of New York, and was the most successful asset forfeiture lawyer in any federal system at the time. And so that's a little bit, I don't even know how to compare it. It's like asking, you know, Eli Manning to show you how to throw a football. I mean, she was the best. And so to have her sign on and offer to intercede on Mongolia's behalf to capture the dinosaur, in essence, that's what happened. And so Prokopy never saw it again except for a moment where he laid out the bones so that they could be inspected by a team of scientists.
I see. Well, so let's step back here because, I mean, Prokopy's story and all that was revealed by it, it's our entree into this larger question of, like, how large is... is it fair to call it the trade or the import-export of fossil relics or dinosaur fossil relics around the world?
It very much is a trade. I don't know. I was never able, in all the years that I reported and worked on this book, I was never able to find anyone to quantify an actual number. The closest you can get may be the big shows in Tucson and Denver that happen every year. Tucson, every February, something like 55,000 to 60,000 people come to town for this enormous gem, mineral, and fossil show and pump like $120 million into the local economy. And Denver is smaller, I think. Kirk, you might know numbers on that since you were in Denver before you were at the Smithsonian.
Tucson's the monster for sure.
The monster.
Yeah. Okay. It's immense. I mean, there are literally thousands of dealers in Tucson over a several-week period. Gems, minerals, fossils, all sorts of stuff.
And this stuff comes from all over the all over the world. But those five countries that you were specifically pointing to earlier, Kirk.
Well, yeah, and remember the dinosaurs are just one type of fossil. And there's plenty of legal fossils coming out. I mean, both in Madagascar and Morocco, there's a huge local business in collecting invertebrate fossils, and those show up by the ton in Tucson and Denver and other stores and in rock shops. And those are considered by those countries as legal exports because they are handicrafts because they've been polished and smoothed off. So this is always the trick about fossils is that some of it's legal and some of it's not. And you have to know a lot to know what's right and what's wrong.
Right. You know, and just to note that the dinosaur fossils are They're valuable, obviously, as scientific and cultural artifacts, but also just their sheer dollar value, right? Because even though that auction in New York was super problematic, when the final bid was, what, more than $1 million?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then later, you know, and I was also remembering Sue, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? Which I think is Sue in Chicago? I can't.
Chicago. Yeah. The Field Museum.
So that was also a fight too. But Sue came from land in the United States. What was the fight about there, Paige?
The fight there was this skeleton had been found near Faith, South Dakota in, what was it, Kirk? Like 1990, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Somewhere around there, and yep. There was a battle over. It's a complicated story, but to sort of boil it down, it was found on land that turned out to be tribal land that turned out to be held in trust by the federal government, which made all kinds of tricky legal raised all kinds of tricky legal questions. Ultimately, the dinosaur was given to the Sioux owner of the land, and he sold it at auction for $8.4 million, which, as Kirk said to me and has said to others, I think, the day that they sold Sue is the day fossils became money.
Wow. And it's the Chicago Field Museum of Natural History. I just looked it up where Sue is. Well, we are having a fascinating conversation about fossils and the fossil trade around the world. Paige Williams is with us. She's author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Kirk Johnson is also with us. He's a paleontologist and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. And we're wondering what your questions are for them about fossils, the ones that we see in museums, the ones that we're hearing are widely traded in multiple shows around the world, and about who should have ownership over them. I want to bring in one more voice here. Frank Garcia joins us. He is with us today from Edgemont, South Dakota, and he is a fossil hunter and collector, and his top finds include an Ice Age fossil pit in Florida in the 1980s and the skull of a mosasaur as well, a huge marine reptile. He found that in 2016. Frank Garcia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How'd you get into this business?
Oh, I got into it when I was 8 years old, and I was just thrilled by my first find there on Lake Okeechobee, finding a sand dollar. Fossilized sand dollar, and throughout my entire life, I've just been infatuated with a lure of discovery. You know, being the first one to see something that's so exciting, and so that's how I did it, and I've made a career out of it. And also, I noticed Paige was talking earlier about being called a paleontologist. I know I'm a fossil finder, and I consider myself one heck of a fossil sleuth, but I did author a paper with Dr. Steve Donovan of Oxford, England, and Dr. Daryl Domning about the sea cow fossils that I found in Jamaica when we went on an expedition in 1987, and it's still unnamed, and they don't know what it is yet. That's what Daryl told me.
Wow. You know, my view of the history of science is that so many great discoveries were made by people who are even more than enthusiastic amateurs, right? They're passionate folks who may not have a PhD behind their names, but some of the people out there doing the discoveries. So power to you, Frank. But let me ask you, I mean, you know, we're talking about the sensitivities around where these fossils come from. I mean, where do you go around the world to do your discoveries, and how do you handle those sensitivities?
Well, I don't go around the world. You know, I mean, the only place I ever been out abroad was to Jamaica when I went with Dr. Daryl Domning for 18 days searching for the world's first manatee that walked on land, and I did find it. I found partial bones of it. But I do my collecting. I did most of my collecting in Florida and just about the whole state of Florida. And then, of course, I got into Nebraska in 1979, started collecting there on a private ranch. And I've then wound up here now, moving up here to Edgemont, South Dakota, about 5 years ago, and now I'm collecting in Wyoming. I have access to a private ranch there, two of them, and, of course, one ranch in Sioux County, Nebraska, and then a ranch near where I live here in Edgemont, where I discovered what Pete Larson says is the world's biggest and best tylosaur and probably a new species. And the skull is over 5 feet long, and I have about 85% of the skeleton, and my wife and I, Debbie, and Gary Brown, we dug the thing up about 2 years ago, and it's totally spectacular. But getting into, you want to get into the politics of it, to be perfectly honest with you, I was 1993, a couple of years after the Sioux debacle, I was harassed by six forestry agents on the Arna Ranch. Uh-huh. And they drove a half a mile into the property, and they wanted to know what I was doing there. And I said, I'm collecting fossils. I got permission here from Mr. Arner, who owned the ranch. And they wanted proof of that. And I said, well, it was a handshake. So then they saw the knife in my back pocket, told me to take it out carefully and put it on the tailgate of my truck, and I did. Took my driver's license and ran a check on me. Of course, I was probably more squeaky clean than any of them were. And the six of them laid against their cruiser with their arms folded, wearing reflector glasses. Uh-huh. Just total intimidation. And to be perfectly honest with you, to make the long story short, they falsified a federal document about me. Said they met me on County Line Road, and it was half mile in the property. So that was a total lie, and that was a felony. And also, to be perfectly honest with you, one more time, all the years that I've been there since 1979 collecting on Arner Ranch, which is just about virtually surrounded by government land, I've yet to see one scientist go out there and save any of those tens and thousands of fossils that have been rotting away there. And I saw the same thing happening in Florida. That's why I was one of the co-authors of the Isolated Fossil Bill in Florida, where we could save some of these fossils that are being destroyed in Florida rivers and oceans.
Paige Williams, let me turn back to you, because Frank is, you know, he's laying it out there. And I think, you know, one of the big parts of this conversation needs to be the tensions between fossil hunters like Frank and various governments versus, and also perhaps the tensions between the fossil hunters and, you know, professional paleontologists. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there are always two sides to every story, right? So, hi, Frank, by the way.
How are you doing, Paige?
I'm good. Good to hear your voice. There's a stark difference between what each side thinks of the other oftentimes. I mean, there are some guys like Kirk has a marvelous way of working with both sides. He knows commercial guys. He knows the paleontology world and can bridge that world. There aren't that many guys like him who can bridge that world and who acknowledge the contributions that amateur and commercial hunters have made to the science for generations, but nothing has been able to bring those two sides together so that each mutually respects the other. The commercial guys are often sometimes added onto scientific papers because they, you know, found a specimen or participated in a dig in some way, and those are generous scientists who give them credit. Not all hunters get credit in scientific papers. Mary Anning is a great – this goes way back, but Mary Anning is a great example of someone whose labors built the reputations of lots of men who are scientists. But
The ichthyosaur discoverer, is that right?
She's discovered lots of things on the Jurassic coast of England in the early 1800s. Poor teenage fossil hunter. And this divide, Kirk may have ideas on this, but this divide often comes down to it's almost a class divide, in that a lot of these guys who hunt commercially and hunt as amateurs might have been paleontologists had they pursued that line had the opportunity to.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I just got 2 minutes to go before the break, and you raised a really interesting question. I just wanted to hear Kirk's view on this because, I mean, Kirk, I take a Paige's point about your ability to work with multiple groups here, but perhaps, I mean, just share what you think some of the concerns of that your colleagues might have. I mean, I imagine that there's a worry about are they concerned that, you know, the manner in which these fossils come out of the ground, if not handled by quote-unquote professional paleontologists, and that, you know, perhaps, you know, they all belong to science and not the commercial trade.
It's such a complicated issue because there's a complete gradation from all sides on this thing. And you saw that Frank found his first fossils 8. He loved the discovery. That's what I did too. And we're both the same. We both love fossils. And there are lots of amateurs who actually do publish scientific papers. The Paleontological Society gives an award called the Harold S. Strimple Award for the amateur paleontologist who's done the most contributions to science. And The one that won last year had published over 100 scientific papers without a PhD. So there's an incursion of science by amateurs, and the challenge really comes down to those bad eggs that are poaching fossils off federal land, or hopping over the fence and taking fossils from private property, or taking fossils and selling them when they should be going to science. So it's a real complicated mix. And there's good eggs and bad eggs across the board. And there's way more fossils out there than there are people, as Frank points out. And there aren't not many professional paleontologists. There's not many commercial paleontologists. There's really actually not that many people that know how to find a fossil in the world. So I try and get us all together and say, look, we got to get together. There's not that many paleontologists out there.
Kids, if you're listening, there's an open market for you to enter to become a paleontologist. There's a demand out there. We're going to be right back in just a second. We're talking with Kirk Johnson. He's paleontologist and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Frank Garcia is also with us. He's a fossil hunter and collector. And Paige Williams, she's author of The Dinosaur Artist. We're going to head off into this break with a little bit of Johnny Cash singing about dinosaurs. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Now, can't you just see yourself walking along, leading your pet Trachodon, or feeding your Brontosaurus Rex, or scratching your Diplodocus neck, or riding on a Stegosaurus back, or swimming in a Brachiosaurus track? Oh, what a time and oh, what fun, playing tag with your Iguanodon. And if we had dinosaurs now, could they get along with a horse and a cow? Well, I wish they hadn't have become extinct. Dinosaurs would be nice pets and friends to have around to run outside and play with every day, don't you think?
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Stuart Butterfield failed in two companies, pivoted, and then built two amazing new companies, Flickr and Slack. Check out How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the fossil trade this hour, and I'm joined by Paige Williams. She's author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Also with us is Frank Garcia. He's a fossil hunter and collector. And Kirk Johnson joins us as well. He's a paleontologist and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Now, I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about Mongolia's efforts and its stepped-up efforts to repatriate a lot of the fossils that have been taken out of the country here, because that's kind of where one of the things that, Paige, your book centers on here. And I just want folks to know that we actually spoke with Balor Minjin. On Point spoke with her. She is really at the center of Mongolia's efforts to get these fossils back. She's a Mongolian paleontologist. And she's the one who originally discovered or noticed, I think, that Tarbosaurus batar skeleton was being auctioned in New York and had questioned its provenance. So we asked her about what are the impacts of fossil poaching on Mongolia. And here's what she told us.
The tourist industry generates a lot of income for the country. And tourists who come to Mongolia, they really want to see the dinosaurs. But then if we keep having these fossil poaching problems, so we lose opportunities to share this. And so also we economically lose the opportunity to bring more money through the industry.
That's Balor Minjin speaking to us here at On Point. Paige Williams, tell us a little bit more about her and about Mongolia's efforts and why it's so important to the country to bring these fossils back.
Balor is the daughter of a geologist who spent his career working in the Gobi Desert. He was trained like a lot of his colleagues and peers from his day in Russia, and then spent his life looking, I believe his expertise was fossil corals. And Bulawar's brother is also a geologist. She grew up wanting to be a paleontologist, but was told that she shouldn't pursue dinosaurs or paleontology at all, actually, because that was man's work. That was work for men, not women. She did it anyway and taught and did her studies in New York at CUNY and at the American Museum of Natural History, and has been instrumental in repatriating lots of illicit Gobi bones back to Mongolia, and is now trying to build a natural history museum at the Flaming Cliffs, which is a prominent and key discovery site in the Gobi.
Yeah, well, we actually talked with her about exactly that, about her goal to build this museum. And here's what she said.
We need a really good, you know, repository for Mongolian fossils. Not only that, also through the museum, really work with the public and the community. And so we basically involve them in every activity, every level of museum, and they can be part of the solution to protect the fossil heritage in the country.
Protecting the fossil heritage of Mongolia. Paige, let me ask you, though. I mean, the Tarbosaurus Bataar skeleton was kind of this extraordinary moment, right? Because it's not that often, I guess, that a full skeleton shows up in auction. Is it harder, though, for Mongolia to protect, again, that fossil heritage of the country where, I suppose, a lot of the bones being taken out of Mongolia are smaller, maybe they're separated, maybe they enter collections in other ways? I mean, it seems like, since it is largely, some of this ends up on the black market, that it would be hard to trace them.
Oh, it's very hard to trace them. Once it's out of the ground, you can't really trace them. I mean, what they know about, what Kirk was saying earlier about the color of the Gobi bones was key in identifying this particular specimen as Gobi, as Mongolian. Other bones turn different colors depending on what sort of groundwater seeped into them millennia ago. This is all sort of necessarily reductive, but the Gobi is vast and unpopulated and unpoliced, and the diggers and the poachers who have found these sites have found them a lot of times by following scientific teams that go into the desert and watching what they do, watching how they do it, and then going back later and taking what's left over. It's extraordinarily hard to police, and it may be impossible to police, actually. So Bowler's idea of getting the public involved and having them sort of self-police this activity is a good one. And she did this by taking basically a New York City bus in 2015 into the Gobi Desert to ride around in this gigantic bus in the Gobi Desert, talking to nomads and others about the importance of fossils.
Wow. She's an extraordinary woman, I have to say. Kirk Johnson, Paige Williams just said something there that was really interesting to me, fossil poachers may sort of try and learn from their observations of scientific teams doing digs. But, I mean, doesn't that raise a concern amongst scientists that they're still not fully properly trained here? I mean, that are fossils being damaged and all the corollary information that comes out of the ground surrounding the fossils isn't being recorded or observed?
Well, you know, there are key fossil sites that scientists go back to year after year. And if those sites get discovered and looted, the whole site can be destroyed. And they might be a bone bed that have hundreds of dinosaurs that are part of a long-term project for a museum. And there have been many cases where scientists are digging, they go away even for lunch and come back and find their fossils have been taken out of their own excavations. So there's some parts of this that are just outright theft, that are despicable. And really any kind of illegal fossil collecting is just that. It's illegal. So there's no argument for that.
But I guess, if sorry to interrupt you here, but I'm really curious about what you think about this because, it's not just the bones that are of scientific value, right? It's where they're found, how they're laid, the strata that they're in, what they're found next to. This is all data, too, that's vital to understand the overall dig.
Sure. And like a really credible commercial paleontologist digging on private land might collect enough of that data to preserve the scientific information and sell that to a museum. That's a totally legitimate transaction.
Yeah.
But there are so many other versions that are just awful because real treasures of the earth that were being excavated by scientists are destroyed by looters and literally destroyed. They'll just go in for the head sometimes and leave the skeleton, or they'll break a bunch of stuff up when they take it out. So again, good apples and bad apples.
Yeah. Well, we are talking about the international fossil trade, and I'm joined today by Kirk Johnson. He is the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Frank Garcia is with us too. He's a fossil hunter and collector. I'm going to come back to you, Frank, here in just a second.
Yes.
And Paige Williams is author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Let's get a couple of calls here. Robert's calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. You're on the air, Robert.
Hi.
Hi. What do you want to share?
Well, I think I have met Kurt at another time. I spent a lot of time in Mongolia with Phil Curry and that group in the Gobi Desert, and have hunted, you know, with the scientific group for the collection, the legal collection of it. And what we found was, in a lot of cases, one particular one, I found a Protoceratops that had evidence of a Velociraptor attack on it. We found the teeth of the Velociraptor, but we didn't have time to collect the entire thing. And the next season that we went over, it was obviously, it was gone. Huh. And we saw such destruction in the field, where they would literally use dynamite. And these things, we were close to the China border, so I think they were going into China and then into the black market, wherever they went from there. My question is, has the laws changed any, or has anything, it's been a long time since I've been back to Mongolia, but has the laws changed any that you know of in Mongolia, where they've clamped down a little bit more on this destruction of fossils?
Robert, thank you for your call. Paige, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I don't actually know what the latest on that is, Robert. I know that the protection of natural history and was nationalized generations ago and was codified into the criminal law in Mongolia. In terms of what's happened since the Prokopi case, I've been told that there's better policing at the border, but I don't think that the code itself or the criminal law has itself changed. There, you can now go to prison for this kind of thing, and that's something you definitely don't want in Mongolia. But other than that, that's as strict as it.
Yeah.
The strictures of several years ago are in place, I think.
And as you were saying earlier, the vastness of the Gobi itself presents some particular challenges. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from New York City. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I was really impressed by The Dinosaur Artist. I found it is entertaining and very educational, and that's hard to do in a lot of nonfiction books. One of the main things in that was the fact that the fossils that are found in the earth are a huge help, or maybe the sole reason of how scientists actually date the planet. So that in and of itself was extremely interesting. I have a question in regards to the commercial hunters or commercial paleontologists versus the actual, you know, the scientists, the true paleontologists, if you will. "Quote unquote," or not "quote unquote," but the true paleontologists who study for decades to understand and learn everything they can about fossils. They're obviously described in the book as they're at loggerheads. Mm-hmm. They don't get along. The scientists think the commercial hunters are out poaching and taking things from places they shouldn't be taking them, which. Do all sorts of things you're discussing currently. My question is there a resolution? This is open to the entire panel. Is there a resolution there to is there a pathway where they could work together?
So some kind of form a symbiosis, I guess, between the groups. Mike, I'm just going to take it back from you there, because I would love to hear Frank Garcia's thought on that. What do you think, Frank?
Well, you know, I just got the book late last night, and I haven't had a chance to read you know, very little of it. But all I can say on my end that is I was hired by the Smithsonian for a 10-year investigation of all chief fossil phosphate properties in Florida, and by Dr. Clayton Ray. And here I had no degree at all. And then, of course, I was the chief ramrod of the world's richest earliest ice age site dig there in Florida, where I discovered. And, you know, We discovered over 214 different kinds of animals, and most of my volunteers were, it was 184 of them, and there was only six from the University of Florida working there. So we did quite well doing that.
Yeah.
And one thing I've got to say is that I have to mention that's important is my daughter gifted me today with a museum, and it's going to be her museum and my museum, and we're going to have it here in Hot Springs, South Dakota. And one section of the museum, we will sell fossils.
Yeah.
There will be meaningless fossils, but we will sell fossils there.
Kirk Johnson, I just want to ask you quickly, the caller had that question about could there be a symbiosis between these scientists or formerly trained scientists and the fossil hunters and collectors out there. Do you imagine that being a possibility more so than maybe, you know, folks like you who are working across groups?
You know, there are plenty of people that work together, and there's, you know, paleontology is spread across the whole world, and there's lots of places where you get amateurs supporting digs, and you have professionals working with amateurs, or museums working with commercial collectors. There's many museums have things that were collected by commercial collectors, and they're coming off of legitimate quarries. So there, that exists today and quite widespread, and I'd say that there are these high-profile cases where there's clearly been something that's inappropriate. But by and large, I try and work the middle because at the end of the day, fossils are amazing stories about our Earth's past, and everybody who digs them really loves them. So there's a sense that we should really be working better together than we are. And I always like to try to figure out how to avoid the strife and get on with the science.
Yeah. Let's get one more call here if we can. Amy is calling from Vandalia, Ohio. You're on the air, Amy.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I've been hearing a lot about quarries and stuff getting stolen out of them while, like you said, people are at lunch and stuff. And people have to understand this. Every bone counts. Like out in Arkansas, they found a foot of a new dinosaur, and they'd love to have the rest of it, but, you know, they haven't been able to find one yet. So every time something gets stolen, we lose that science. And every time something gets auctioned to some silly rich guy and it goes in his living room, nobody gets a chance to study it. There's one dinosaur. They only have four of them in the entire world, and three of them are in private hands, and the one they do have is kind of crummy. So they can't even tell you much about it because they don't have a chance to study them.
Yeah. Well, Amy,
so it's just a shame that this stuff keeps happening.
Amy, thank you for your call. Just got a couple of minutes left. And Paige Williams, I mean, Amy talked about with a little more than a little bit of derision about rich guys collecting fossils for their personal collections. I just have to get Nicolas Cage here. He makes a little cameo in this big story about
Does make a little cameo. He's a huge collector of lots of different categories, from what I understand, from what I've read in the media, like everyone else. And he at one point got into fossils and bought at auction a Tarbosaur head that Eric Procopi auctioned also in New York. Can't remember what year that was, 2007-ish, something like that. Gigantic head that ended up having to be, the federal government came to him and said, we need this back. Mongolia wants it back. And he surrendered the dinosaur skull.
He did. Okay. Well, but Mongolia had to ask for it back. Okay.
Yeah.
So we've just got a minute here left to go. I mean, Paige, you spent years researching this. I mean, the science, the characters, the politics of this. I mean, what most did you, when you came away from all of this research, what most did you love about the story that you'd uncovered?
The whole thing. In fact, Magna, I had trouble letting it go because it was so fascinating to me. And I was late with the book because I just wanted to know more and more and more. And I found it fascinating that the story ran through so many different, it had so many different threads, including the geopolitical importance of Mongolia, which is sandwiched between Russia and China, and as a friend of North Korea. It's very important to the United States diplomatically. I just thought that was fascinating, too. So I could have lived in that world longer. I at some point, you have to break away and do something else. But I'm envious of guys like Kirk and Frank and others who get to inhabit that world all the time.
Oh, well, Kirk Johnson, my last question goes to you. And the next time someone drops by the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History, what's your favorite thing that you think they ought to take a look at?
Well, the amazing thing is June 8th of next year, we're reopening the National Fossil Hall, which was closed in 2014. It opened in 1911, and it's a complete redo, and it's got in it a Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton, bigger than a Tarbosaur, that was collected by a rancher in Montana on federal land and is on loan to the Smithsonian from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So the fossils find their way to the museums, and it's a great story. So come to Washington, D.C.
Next year, next June. Okay.
June 8th.
It's in my calendar. Kirk Johnson, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, thank you so much. And Frank Garcia, fossil hunter and collector, thank you. And Paige Williams, author of The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for the Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Thank you all as well. What a great hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.